You're up and away.
Yeah, we met up earlier this week with an old friend from West Wyalong. His name was Nola. Nola's about, I suppose, he's older than us, Jenny and I. And it's a friendship we've kept up since 28 years since we left the church there. And I'll never forget a story she told me when I first arrived. Nola and her husband were not Christians, but had an association with our church. And their eldest daughter was tragically killed, age 12, by a burning log on the farm. And she recalls the story of the funeral. After the funeral, she remembers in the car driving down the main street of West Wyalong. And now in those days, and probably still, when a funeral procession goes through town, shop doors shut and people stand on the footpath. But nevertheless, she was overwhelmed with this anger, saying to herself, why are all these people going about their everyday business when my life has totally ended? And I always remembered that story. Now, it had a good ending because Nola and John and the entire family became Christians. But I tell that story because life does go on. And we find ourselves as a family moving from shock and disbelief into the next stages of grief. Now, I've been away for 2 weekends, but I know that you, Pete's talked to you well about grief in that time. And so today I want to try and help us into the next stage. And if you need to excuse yourself, please go and make a coffee and sit out the back. I won't be offended if it's too hard. But today I've sort of, for the point of putting a title on it, it's moving forward versus moving on. Moving forward versus moving on. And to qualify that, I'm implying that, you know, we're getting on with life and trying to forget. But moving forward is growing with grief, as Peter's talked about. And it's carrying your loss like a backpack as you travel through the valley of the shadow of death, as Mike has talked about. There's so many ways God has prepared us for this moment. And Mike's sermon on the valley of the shadow of death was part of that. And the fact that even Mike and Kathy are here with us, and they have an enormous experience in tragic loss. And the fact that Peter's here with us, Peter Junior here with us, with a lifetime of ministry experience. I give thanks to God for that right now. But nevertheless, needless to say, the loss of Carolyn 3 weeks ago has been very, very unsettling. And I've been thinking a lot about it. Why is it so unsettling? Well, we are simply not used to murder, and let alone brutal murder. You know, we're not even used to untimely death. I was thinking on the way in this morning, most of our Western industry is about insulating us from untimely death. Because we want to be able to control absolutely everything. And we feel angry with God. Abandoned, overwhelmed, feel like giving up. Unspeakable evil has violated our family here, our church family. And we're used to seeing these things in the news. But this is close to home. Not only is it close to home, it's within our home. It's within our home because this is our other home. And we have no reason for this senseless atrocity. The early church, so I've turned to the early church over the last 3 weeks. The early church was in a similar situation at least 4 times. And I'm at least satisfied that they were not immune either. We're not the first ones to be here. And I'll just quickly talk about 4 incidents. Firstly, there's the incident of Stephen in Acts chapter 7. But Stephen, full of the Holy Spirit, looked up to heaven and saw the glory of God, and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. "Look," he said, "I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." And at this they covered their ears and yelled at him at the top of their voices. They all rushed at him, dragged him out of the city, and began to stone him. Meanwhile, the witnesses laid their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. And we know how that ends. The second incident, James, the disciple, brother of John, in Acts chapter 12, verse 12. "It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. When he saw that this met with approval among the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also." Thirdly, James, the brother of Jesus, which is not mentioned in the New Testament, but he was murdered in Jerusalem either AD 62 or AD 69. This is James, the brother of Jesus, who wrote the book of James. And then fourthly, again, something not mentioned in the New Testament, but we know from ancient history, from the Roman historian Tacitus, that in AD 64 in Rome, a massacre of vast multitudes under the Emperor Nero, AD 64, we should be glad they didn't give up. We wouldn't be here today. The world would be 10 times worse than it is now. But however, in some respects, our situation isn't completely comparable. Their situation was at least comprehensible. You know, we had despotic rulers, Roman rulers, rulers of the religious hierarchy. But our situation seems totally incomprehensible. Their situation was for a clear cause, the advance of the gospel, the message of the resurrection. And their cause seemed to trigger important gains, and this is not the time, but we could go through so many different gains that were benefited from their martyrdom. But ours, we just, hard to see. And also, in 2 instances, Peter, Acts chapter 12, was miraculously saved. There was a jailbreak, and you might remember Rhonda, the girl that answered the door and did not believe that Peter had escaped. And from there we read that Peter went to some other place, and we believe he held the fort or formed the Church of Rome. And then also Paul, in Acts 14:19, was stoned and dragged outside the city and left for dead. That those who had stoned him carried him outside and dumped him, believing him to be dead. And we read that the church, the brothers, gathered around him and lifted him up. Now, sounds a bit like he was dead. If not, he was very, 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 very poor condition. Either way, God's miraculous hand was on the situation. And we believe in an interventionist God. The God of the Bible is an interventionist God. And I believe, have witnessed this intervention so many times. And if not, we wouldn't be feeling so disappointed and so angry. Many scriptures talk of God's protection, particularly Psalm 95. So we've led to believe that we have immunity, and I don't see there's any harm in believing in God's protection always, and that's understandable. Let's think for a moment about prayer. I hope this helps you. I pray this helps you. Is prayer always answered? Well, I'm going to beg to differ. I believe prayer is always answered. Always answered. If I pray this morning on the way home, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in our church, that prayer is answered. But the answers could be yes, no, yeah, nah, which our culture understands. Sort of. Wait. Yes, but wait. Yes, if. Yes, if. Or I'll get back to you. We could keep coming. Prayer is always, I believe prayer is always it. And in a similar vein, we can think of intervention. I believe, likewise, about prayer, that God is always intervening in some manner. But most of it's imperceptible. Luke 12:6. Are not five sparrows sold for two pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God, or in the other gospel it says, outside of his care. Not one of them is forgotten by God or outside of his care. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. And the context of this was whom to fear. Whom to fear. These verses imply God's constant involvement, care, and activity. At the very least, counting our hairs every morning. Watching sparrows. Be afraid of nothing, Jesus says. Be afraid of nothing if you honor God who bestows on you enormous worth. Far more than the sparrows. No offense against sparrows. But far more than the sparrows. I would like to share a work story for you. And you might think, well, where's this going to? But bear with me. I do a lot of work in supermarkets for ventilation, and most supermarkets have what's called a smoke exhaust system. And it's built into the building for the occasion when the fire breaks out. You're not even aware of them existing, but they do. And so the job of the smoke exhaust system is to lift the smoke and keep it above head high whilst the occupants get out of the building. And these things are designed with a computer program called computational fluid dynamics. And what it does is, it's a model that you set up of the building space, and then the designer positions a fire of a certain size in a certain location, and then a certain amount of fuel, and so all the inputs are all put into the computer, and then they let go and they watch this program models the amount of smoke in every single area at every single height and creates a model that then the building certifies, says, oh yes, this building is safe. They have modeled the constraints. Now, that's a fairly simple situation. That is one building of a certain height with a certain fire in a certain spot. Do you know how long it takes for a big computer to model that? When they put in all the inputs, they turn it on, get the program going, and Friday at 5 p.m. as they walk out the door. And on Monday morning, they get the result. That computer, a really powerful computer, takes all weekend just to model that situation. Does that surprise you? If God was a million supercomputers, think about how many computational inputs and code are required to influence and order the lives of 8 billion people on the planet, let alone the sparrows. And not just the people alive now, but those future. And all of those people are free agents to choose good or evil, or any number of nuances between good and evil, which we all are a mixture of. And free will is a prerequisite for love to exist. You've probably heard this before, but I'll explain it again. If I was to say to my grandson, hey, give us a cuddle goodbye, and he says no, and if I force that cuddle out of him, does love exist? No. So love and free will is really the reason for the universe. God thought love was worth everything. And for love to exist, we must be free to love him. Last Sunday morning, about 6:30 in the morning, I decided to go for a walk on the farm where we were staying at. And out at West Wyalong, the mornings and the evening skies are particularly beautiful. And so I was on my own walking out into the paddock, and I was talking to God about this intervention that I wished we had. And I believe he said something like this. You can test this. I'm not saying this is a prophecy. I'm just saying this is what I feel. I felt. Test it. See what you think. But it sounded like this. If I intervened for justice in the ways that so many people want on every occasion, that would put me at war with humanity. God would be constantly smiting us. Now we can say, well, what about Adolf Hitler? Surely you could have made an exception. But his way, the new covenant, is now turn the cheek. Maybe in the old covenant, God wouldn't smite Adolf Hitler. But his way is now turn the other cheek. And God cannot be a hypocrite. God cannot be a hypocrite. In him, all things are true and right. Do we want God's nature to be changed? No, we don't. And this way of turning the cheek, he modeled on the cross. In Matthew 26, 52 to 54, in the garden,
there was another option when one of his disciples pulled a sword. Put your sword back in its place, Jesus said to him, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? That's a lot of angels. But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way? It must happen this way. Of course, we so deeply wish some other radical intervention was given to Carolyn, and how much more would Paul and his children be feeling that? But it wasn't to be. I'd like to read to you a poem that I've appreciated. You've probably heard it before many times, but we'll give it a go again. It was reportedly... It is attributed to Corrie ten Boom, but I've since read on the internet that's probably not the case. But anyway, Corrie ten Boom approves. It's called The Tapestry Poem. It may be familiar to all of you. And when we're reading this, think about not just one tapestry, but there is a multitude of tapestries being woven together. My tapestry and Jenny's tapestry are woven together. My tapestry and my sons and daughters' tapestry and my grandchildren are woven together. It's not quite as simple as this. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colours. He weaveth steadily. Oft times he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget he sees the upper, and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and reveal the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand, as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. He knows, he loves, he cares. Nothing this truth can dim. He gives the very best to those who leave the choice to him. So, people, we're moving forward. We're not moving on. And a verse came to me sometime over the last 3 weeks, which I'm about to read. Michael, do you mind putting up? Or maybe I can do it myself. Thank you. And it's from 2 Corinthians 4:10. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. And we will always carry around with us the death of Carolyn. Of course, it's very different to the death of our Saviour, but nevertheless, we will always carry around her death. She died in him, and in some way, she died for him. And the life of Jesus is now revealed in her body. Just before this verse I've just read are the following verses, which I'm sure you have heard before. We are hard pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down,